Good morning. So, test, okay, good. Test mic works. So, last time we talked about some bit manipulation operations. We started with bit shifting, which was a way we could take a value we had in something like a register and move bits to the left or right. And that, because of how binary works, is very similar to dividing or multiplying by a power of 2. And we had these various variations of these bitwise operators, where the big decision was when we move bits to the left or the right, like what do we put in the extra bits? So for the cases where it was equivalent to multiplying by a power of 2, it was easy. We put in zeros, because that sort of made the most sense. In the other case, we had different answers that made more sense for signed versus unsigned numbers. We had this arithmetic shift where we would copy the sign bit for the extra bits. We had this logical shift where we would add zeros, which would be more like what we want for unsigned. We also talked about the other bitwise operators that generally treat our numbers as an array of bits and do an operation for most of these operators on each pair of bits from two operands. So the ones place, then the twos place, then the fours place, and so on. And we talked about three of these that are available in C and sort of have this meaning we can think of that will be helpful when we want to like do something to the bits of a number. So the ampersand or and operator, we can think of as extracting a bit or clearing bits, depending on what we AND with. And sort of the big idea we had as far as what we AND with is we call that a mask, and we put a 1 where we wanted to do one operation, like extracting bits, and a 0 otherwise. And similarly, OR looked like setting a bit, and XOR looked like flipping a bit, with that same idea that we'd set this mask saying where we wanted the set bits or where we wanted the flip bits. We started looking at bit puzzles, which we did some of yesterday or possibly earlier, and we mentioned that we had this divide and conquer approach for solving these puzzles that went through this one example of doing this ternary operator, this if x then y else c, with just bitwise operators using that divide and conquer approach to figure out how do we solve this relatively complicated problem. And our answer was, well, first we're going to solve these simpler, very similar problems, and we'll expand our solutions out to get a full solution. And when I finished up, I briefly mentioned something about these bit puzzles. So we were doing these bit puzzles because they help us understand bitwise operators, because they kind of help us understand the tools the hardware has to work with. Because you might see these in other contexts, but a lot of the operations you do, it might look like, oh, we're doing these things that are fast in the hardware, therefore it's going to be fast, and that's even less true than it might look like, because you say, oh, AND is a lot simpler than AND. That's very true. In hardware, you can make a lot more efficient circuits that do ANDs than ADDs, but hardware usually really cares about making ADDs fast relative to how much they care about making ANDs fast, so usually they'll be about the same speed in a typical processor, just because that's what the processor designer's priorities are, because most programs, they do AND operations, but they don't do nearly as many as they do additions. So I'm going to go over one more strategy for dealing with these bit puzzles. But before I do that, questions about things we covered last time? Okay, so not seeing any. So for a second example of bit puzzles to illustrate a strategy, I'm going to solve the puzzle of making some expression that tells us is any bit of some X set. And we've seen some solutions for this that will basically give us a 1 if any bit is set or 0 otherwise. We saw the using the logical negation, the bang operator, to do this. And in lab, you saw a way of implementing the bang operator without the bang operator. But both of these from a perspective of how would the hardware actually do this, are actually seem pretty cheap. So using the bang operator means the hardware has a circuit that sees if a number is zero or not. Seems like kind of cheating to use that. And the way that you probably did it in lab is that you used the addition operator, and addition is pretty complicated relative to checking if a number is zero. So let's think about how we could do this otherwise. And like with our problem of the ternary operator, I'm going to try to simplify this problem first. And the way I'm going to simplify it is I'm going to say, let's start with x being really small. So the general problem is x is any number, and I want to see if any bit of x is set. Let's say x is a 4-bit number. So how can I do this with a 4-bit number? So my strategy is going to be, well, let's just extract each of the 4 bits, move them to the least significant bit, so turn, you know, no matter where the bits are set in the number, turn them to 0 or 1. So if it's like the bit in the 2's place, move it over by 1 so it's in the 1's place. And OR them all together, because remember, OR is set. If either of the operands are set, OR's result's going to be set. So that gives us a solution for 4 bits. So questions on how I came up with this? What I'll call a naive solution for a 4-bit x. Yes? Question is, what's the overall problem? So the overall problem is if x is 0, I want an expression that results in 0. If x is anything else, I want an expression that results in 1. That answer your question? Other questions? Yes?
Are you explaining the order of operation of the operator? Like, we can do the operator.
Can I explain the order of operation of the operators? So in what I've written down, I've used a bunch of parentheses, that some of which might not be necessary, because I don't want to memorize the order of operations, because I get it wrong. And whenever I need to know it, I look it up. Yes? The question is, how did I get this expression? So I want to see if any of these bits are set. So my first task is going to be to extract each of the bits. So our first expression, first part of this expression, x and 1, extracts the 1's place bit. The second expression, I extract the 2's place bit. I do that by moving the 2's place bit to the 1's place bit, and then extracting it by ending with 1, so to clear all the other bits, and so on. So I'm extracting all the bits and moving them to the 1's place for each of the sub-expressions, and I'm ORing those together, so if any of them are 1, the result will be 1. If none of them are 1, the result will be 0. Other questions? Okay. So now that we have this expression, let's work on making this more efficient. Because if we can do this strategy, say, for a 32-bit or a 64-bit number, but it's going to get a bit unwieldy. So we're going to want to see, like, how can we avoid that? And there's some things we can start out with. So one is that I'm ending with 1 a bunch of times to ignore all but the 1's place. And I'm doing that right now at the beginning, basically. One of my early steps is get rid of all but the 1's place. I could instead say, let's have numbers in all the other places until the very end, and then I'll get rid of all the other places. And so that gives me this solution. So basically, I'm just saying, oh, I was getting rid of everything but the 1's place multiple times in each part. Instead, I can just do that at the end. Yes, there's going to be weird values in the other places, but I don't care because at the end I'm going to get rid of those values by ending with 1. So questions on why this transformation works? So that got rid of some stuff, but if we went to do the 32-bit or 64-bit version of this, it's still going to be crazy. So can we do better than that? And the answer is we can. And the reason why is that if we look at what we're doing here, we're actually calculating some of the values we need multiple times. We're just not using that we calculate them multiple times. Now let's look at that. So let's look at this first part here, this x ord with x shifted over 1. So this is a bitwise OR. And remember, a bitwise OR, we have this array of OR operators. And right now, we're just using the results of one of those, that array of OR gates. But let's look at what the other ones are computing. Because ideally, what we'd like is we'd like to use, you know, as many of these as possible. Because if we think about the overall operation we want to do, we want to OR all the bits together. Ideally, we could just do that with one bitwise OR, because a bitwise OR does 4 ORs. So let's see what we're doing already. So here are the two numbers we're ORing together. I've represented bit 0 of x, namely the least significant bit as x sub 0, bit 1 as x sub 1, and so on. So I have x and x shifted over 1. When I shifted over 1, I shifted into 0. And my bitwise OR, in the 1's place, I get x1 ORed with x0. In my 2's place, I get x2 ORed with x1. In my 4's place, I get x3 ORed with x2, and so on. And I've highlighted two of these, which are interesting. And that's because, well, x3 ORed with x2, that's what we're trying to compute with this part of the expression. And I'm already computing it over here, I'm just not using it. So if I just looked at the value I was already computing, it turns out I already had that second part of the computation, and I don't need to do it again if I just move it to the right place. So how would I move it to the right place? So right now, it's in bit 4. It's in the 4's place. I want it in the 1's place. I want to shift it over by 2 bits. And we have an operator that can do that, the bit shift operator. So that gives a strategy I can use here. So I can take the result I got, which I've called y now, shift it over by 2, and now I've lined up my x1 OR with x0 and my x3 OR with x2. And if I OR them together, then in that 1's place, I get my answer with one less OR operation. And it's not because I'm doing less ORs overall, it's because I'm ignoring the results of less ORs. Now, this still seems actually remarkably inefficient because I'm computing this value, and this value, and this value, sorry, and this value, and this value, and this value that I don't care about. But it's at least better. So questions about how this works? So this sort of strategy gives us a solution like this. Okay. So this is with 4 bits, but I can extend this idea to more bits than that. I'm going to do this, what I'll call a fan-in. Like I'll have like sort of kind of like a tree structure where at the bottom I get my answer. And I'm just combining these subproblems later. So my version with, say, 8 bits is that first I do the steps of computing, you know, any of 4 bits for the first 4 bits in bit 0, in place, you know, the 1's place, bit 0, And for the next four bits in the 16th place, bit four, and so on. And I can extend this out to 16 bits, 32 bits, and so on. So I'm just repeating this pattern. And at the end here, what would I do? I'd combine these by shifting over by four. And I guess I'll mention that I'm doing a strategy where I shift by one, then by two, so I do the pairs, then the pairs of the pairs. I could have done this in a different order and still gotten the same answer. This is just the order I chose for illustration. But the key idea is that I observed, oh, my bitwise operator, that's really doing a whole bunch of calculations at once. Let's try to take advantage of that. And it happened that in this case, taking advantage of it didn't require me to do any special effort to arrange for, you know, the values to be in the proper places at the beginning, because I was already doing useful calculations. If that wasn't the case, maybe it would have been useful for me to move values around so I'd have that case where, you know, the ones place and the fours place were both computing interesting things. And so this gives an overall solution for 32 bits. So questions on how I came up with this? Or how this works? Yes? That is for you to figure. So the question is, if you change this to XORs, is it bit parity? That's for you to figure out. But does seem related. Other questions? So you're asking what happens to the second bit in, is it Y or Z here?
Is it X1 or X2?
X1 or X2? So the X1 in this example, our first OR operation ORs it with X0 because the shifted over by one version has it in the ones place. If you're asking what happens to the twos place, like after we do the OR, what's in our two's place in the result of that OR, it's X2 OR with X1, which in this example I have chosen not to use. Like it's a potentially useful value, but I have that information elsewhere, so I just discard it. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Okay, so besides this parallelism, some strategies I'd like to remind people of for doing the homework are, for the bitwise operators, like find subproblems, write things down, don't just try random things, please. Remember the idea of making masks to select bits you want. Remember that you can shift to move the bits to, usually you want to work with them in the least significant bits, so you can shift to do that. Note this idea that we started with of, oh, that when I have things like anding with one, you know, if I'm doing some operation over and over again near the beginning, maybe I can move that later. That pattern comes up a bunch and can be a thing that might be helpful if you're running into, am I using too many operations? Look for that sort of issue where there's something you're doing that's redundant that you could do it just once instead of multiple times. Try to divide and conquer, find these simpler subproblems. And also, something that comes up sometimes is look for things that you are computing twice that are just the same value. Like in our example of ternary, we actually computed exclamation point X multiple times, and if I wanted to write a minimum operation solution, I should explicitly compute that to a temporary value. So questions about, yes? Do I need that and of one? Yes. So if we look at what was happening, for example, in our any case, the 2's place and the 4's place and the 8's place all have values which are not going to be zero all the time, and we want them to be zero because our answer should be 0 or 1. Does that answer your question?
Yeah.
Other questions? Okay, so let's do an exercise here. So I would like to swap the least significant bit of x and the second least significant bit of x. So which of these, if any, do that? Give you a minute or two. I would recommend writing things down. So usually the way I handle this is I like write the bits down as letters like I've done here and like figure out what operations are we doing. You know, what's the number as written down as letter for each bit after we do each of these things. So the question is this little or big endian? It doesn't matter because we don't have indexing, right? I should have least significant. I probably should have written least significant. But other than that, we don't have any way of saying there's a first or last bit, right? Or first or second or third bit. Question is, should you keep the rest of the bits the same? Please. Like in the example. Okay, who'd like some more time? Okay, a few people. Another minute or so. Okay, so let's see where we are. So who thinks A is correct? A is a correct way of doing this. B? Okay, a couple. C? D? Okay, so it seems like most people have figured it out. So let's go over how I went through these. Is that I figured only the last few bits mattered. So I wrote out, okay, let's say the number is UV, W, X, Y, Z, where each of those represents one bit. So the shift over one turns that into zero, UV, W, X, Y, zero because this is unsigned, and also because I assume there's a bunch of zeros in front, because it's not the whole unsigned number. And then I end with one, so that extracts the Y, so I've moved the second to last bit to the last bit, which seems like good progress. Unfortunately, the rest of the expression, I remove the last bit from with our ending with tilde 1. So tilde 1 has is 1, 1, 1, 1, 1, 0. So I end up with u, v, w, x, y, and when I OR those together, 0 ORed with u is u, 0 ORed with v is v, and so on. And I get U, V, W, X, Y, Y. So I've duplicated the second to last bit into the last bit, which is not quite what we were looking for. For B, I have the same thing happening on the first part of the expression. For the second part, I move the last bit and all the other bits over by one. And then rather than extracting the second to last bit, which was the previous last bit's value, I ended with tilde 2, which clears that bit because it has a 0 in the 2's place and 1's everywhere else. And then the last expression, I've extracted all but the last 2 bits, and when I OR these together, I can pretty clearly see I'm not going to get the answer we want. An easy way to see that is that this 2's place of my result is going to be 0 instead of z. Then version C was the correct one, so I said, okay, the first part of the expression, I'm ending with tilde 3 that has a 1 in every place but the last 2, so that extracts everything but the last 2 bits. The second part extracts the last bit, z, and moves it over to the 2's place. And the last part moves the number over by 1, so I get u, v, w, x, y, and then it extracts that y, which used to be the second to last bit, which is now in the 1's place. And I OR these together, and I see, oh, 0 OR with 0 is 0, or with y is y. So I have y in the ones place, 0 or with z is z, z or with 0 is z. So I have z in the twos place and x in the fours place and so on. Yes? So question is, why does this first part of the expression extract, remove the last two bits? So 3 in here is 1, 1 in base 2. So when I flip all the bits, this is 3 equals that. So tilde 3 is going to be, is going to have zeros in the last two places and ones everywhere else. Because remember that this 1, 1 in base 2 is 1, 1 with a bunch of leading zeros. And we flip all the bits. The question is, don't we need to add 1 for what reason? Okay, so you're asking, you're saying this doesn't look like negating a number. It is not. So this is the tilde operator, the complement operator. This is complement, which is represented by the tilde character, which is not the same as the minus operator, the negation operator. So the negation operator, you're right, would flip the bits and add 1. That's not what this is. Yeah, this is not negation. That is correct. Other questions? Okay, and finally we have version D. So version D, we have our first part of the expression, which I think we've seen before, which extracts our last bit and moves it into the second to last bit place, the second least significant place, I should say. And the second part of the expression extracts the last two bits by ending with 3, so we get yz, least significant two bits. And it shifts over by 1, so we end up with y in the ones place and 0 in all the other places. So we OR those together, we get zy, that seems promising. And then we xOR with x. So we have the right bits in everything but the ones and twos place. But if we look at what the XOR does, well, we are doing, we have 0 or XOR with Y is Y, or 0 OR with Y is Y, so we have Y, which we're XORing with Z in the ones place, which is not what we want in our answer. So questions on how I figured that out? Okay, and a reminder for when you're solving the puzzle problems that you don't need to write out a solution like this in one line. You can like make your code readable. It's allowed. Okay, and I think that's where I'm going to move on to our next topic, unless there are other questions about bitwise, bit manipulation. Yes?
The question is, how does x and the complement of 3 get the rest of the bits?
So 3 is a bunch of zeros and two ones in binary. Yep. Agreed? So the complement of 3 is going to flip all those bits. So that's going to be give us a bunch of ones and two zeros. And if we remember what we said about how AND works, AND, you supply it a mask where you have ones for the bits you want to keep and zero for the bits you want to clear. And that's exactly what we've produced, where the bits we want to keep are everything but the last two. Okay. Other questions? So our next topic is going to be instruction set architectures. We're going to have to start by defining that, but instruction sets are the instructions that a processor has decided to provide to you, and we've seen that they don't just include the obvious things that you find in every programming language, like addition, multiplication, and so on, but we also have these other operations that, like in these bitwise operations, we decided was convenient to provide to you. And there's a lot of other decisions, and we're going to talk about some of them that are made in making instruction set architectures, and as you can see from this list, there's a huge list of instruction set architectures out there. So we happen to use, in this class, x86 as our instruction set architecture because that's what is currently dominant in desktop servers, laptops, but there's a whole bunch of others. ARM is probably the most prominent because it's by far the most common in things like cell phones. But there's a lot of others, and you might say, why do people design so many? And there's probably not great reasons for that. Like, maybe you could have reused an existing one. But with lots of different features, and even though we're going to be focusing on one particular ISA, it's good to know, like, what sort of different design philosophies are behind this, or are they just all examples of trivial variations that don't matter? And there are some real design differences that are interesting. We're going to try to touch on those. Now, to talk about instruction set architectures, I want to distinguish between that and what we'll call microarchitecture. So you can have the same instructions implemented by different designs of hardware. And we'll call the design of the hardware the microarchitecture. And the instruction set is the interface that software sees. And for example, x86, you have different x86 chips which implement essentially the same instruction set, where you can take the same software and run it on these different pieces of hardware, which might have been redesigned at some point to have a very different way things work internally. So the way we were designing processors in the early days of the x86 architecture is very, very different than the way we design them now, but we still support the same software interface on those newer processors, even though the actual hardware design, the way things will be computed, and so on is very different. And even the same company might manufacture different microarchitectures. So for example, Intel has a microarchitecture it manufactures that targets really low power and one that's more for desktops. Those are very different internal hardware designs, but they still implement both the x86 instruction sets, the same software interface, even though they have a different hardware design because they want to do very different things to get very low power than to get good performance that you want on something like a server. So with this idea in mind, which of these changes to a processor would change the instruction set? If you have 45 seconds to think about it, ask or check with your neighbors. Okay, who'd like some more time? Okay, a few people. Okay, so who thinks A? Okay, who thinks B? Who thinks C? Okay, who thinks D? Okay, who thinks E? Okay, so we have good consensus that D is an instruction set change, and it is, because this is going to make software we wrote that assumed that we could use a multiply instruction not work. It changes the software interface. And I think our next most common was E. So E is also a change. So adding features that the software could use is also an instruction set change, because if we write a program for the new, more featureful instruction set and try to use it on a processor that doesn't implement that, it won't work. That's a software interface change. Yes, it might be a backwards compatible one, but it's still an instruction set change. So making the add instruction have more options would be an instruction set change, and this is changing like how it has to appear in assembly and so on. And for the same reason, increasing the number of registers we'd have available would also be an instruction set change. So yes, maybe it would be backwards compatible, but if we write something for the new instruction set and run it on a processor that doesn't implement on the old processor, it won't work. And the key thing is that it needs to still work the same. Software should work the same if it's the same instruction set. And this also means that C is an instruction set change. So the instruction set includes the machine code, because part of the software interface is what compilers and assemblers are doing to use the processor. So the machine code is included. So if we change the machine code, we're changing the instruction set, even if the assembly didn't change. Because I can't take like a compiler and assembler built for one processor and use it in the other. I need different software. And B is not an instruction set change. So it's true that maybe you'd like to know how fast add instructions are, if you're a compiler, to decide whether to use add or something else. Like, that's useful, but your program will still work correctly even though I've made the add instruction faster or slower. So that's not part of the software interface. It's just how efficient is the processor. That we consider just entirely a microarchitectural issue, because there's nothing that's going to change whether my program's correct or not based on whether the add instruction got slower or faster. So questions about how I came up with these answers? Yes?
The instructions that reference both the assembly and the machine code, or is it just the machine code?
Question is, does the instruction set reference both the assembly and the machine code? So it's only the stuff the hardware actually implements. Usually we consider the assembly part of that because it's kind of dictated by what the machine code looks like. But we still consider it the same instruction set if you write that assembly differently. Right? We don't say that there's two x86 instruction sets because of AT&T and Intel syntax. We consider it the same assembly insofar as like you take the machine code and there's some assembly you produce from that based on what the units of the machine code are. Other questions? Yeah.
I was just wondering like why increasing the number of registers isn't a
question is why increasing the number of registers isn't a thing we've done in a while. Well, we did it in the early 2000s or late 90s, whenever x86-64 happened. We'll probably, I guess we won't. So that's a good question, is why we haven't done that. And there's empirical reasons probably why not. As we'll learn much later in the semester, the number of registers available to assembly is not the same thing as the number of registers in the processor. And in fact, on a current processor, typically per core, there's probably something like a couple hundred registers, but they're not visible to assembly. But speaking of structure characteristics, what are some goals when designing instruction sets that we should have in mind? What are things we should be thinking about to choose what our instruction set looks like? So any volunteers? Things that would be useful attributes of an instruction set. If you were making a new one, what are some things you'd like it to be true about it? Yeah. Okay, so Turing complete. That seems like a good goal. So, and I think there's something we're getting at there, which is that, you know, we can write useful programs for it, which is probably a stronger property than Turing completeness, right? Just because something's Turing complete doesn't mean we want to have things that we actually make useful programs. So other properties? Yeah. Okay, so doesn't require many instructions for typical tasks. Instructions, we'll say, for important tasks. And there's a good question of, well, you'd have to come up with a list of what's important. But that's indeed something that an instruction set designer might do. Some other attributes? So, okay, so like the, would have a human usable assembly? Yeah, so you're saying assembly that can be easily used by humans. Okay, some other attributes. So far, everyone's come up with attributes that are things where we're thinking from the perspective of like someone who's making a compile or writing assembly. Can we think of some attributes we'd want from the perspective of someone making hardware? Yeah.
Less instructions.
So less stuff to implement in hardware? Sure. That might be an attribute we might want that conflicts with some of these others. Yeah? So instructions that are fast to instructions we can implement quickly. Can implement efficiently, I should say. That's another attribute, and that might contradict some of our other goals. Yeah?
Compatibility.
So compatibility with an older instruction set. With another instruction set. Yeah. Anything else? Okay, so, you got something? Sorry? So, okay, so storage on the processor, control amount of hardware needed, amount of storage needed, sure. So we might have goals about hardware resources. Yeah, so we have a bunch of goals, and something I'd like you to observe is that some of these goals might be in conflict. We have some goals as far as making it so we can make good hardware implementations of this, or like easily make hardware implementations. We have some goals about making it easy to use, some goals about making it efficient, and these often when we look at our decisions, might not all lead us to the same place. So let's look at what some existing instruction sets do. And one high-level way of looking at it is how big the machine code is and how many, what I call normal registers, what something called general-purpose registers, things like x86s, RAX, RBX, and so on, there are, and how many different instructions they implement. And you can see there's this wide variation. We have x86, 64, which you've learned. We have the subset that our textbook has of that, that you'll actually implement YD6 64. And then we have all these others, and you can see we have this one big decision is how do we encode instructions? Do we have variable length encoding, which gives us the ability to have simple instructions have short encodings and longer instructions not, or do we not, like many of these other instructions do, instruction sets do? How many registers do we have? So x86-64 went up to 16 registers from the 8 of 32-bit x86. Many other architectures decided, oh, maybe we want more than that, 32, 31, 128, and some older, simpler architectures have less, like 7 or 8. And then there's sort of just the amount of instructions we specify. So x86-64 has a huge number of instructions. I say approximate number because it depends on, like, is 16-bit add and 32-bit add a different instruction or not? It depends how you count exactly, but it's a huge number of instructions. And a lot of these other instruction sets have kind of gotten big, probably more by accident. So this is one sort of high-level view of different instruction sets. Yes?
Why would you need variable length encoding if you only have 18 instructions?
The question is, why would you need variable length encoding if you only have 18 instructions? So as we'll see, some instructions have more stuff in them. So like a move a constant to a register has the constant, and like a push RAX doesn't have much. And we'd like that push to be very small, but that move can't be very small. That answer your question? So that's, yeah, so because there's just different information in different instructions, that's the reason we want a variable length encoding. The main disadvantage of a variable length encoding is that it's going to be trickier to implement in hardware. Yes? The question is, if we have a load effective address, that all the arguments will be encoded in one instruction? Yes. So when I'm saying instruction length, that length includes the length of the full machine code for an instruction, including all its operands. Or the closest equivalent. So in some cases, especially the ones with asterisks, there's either exceptions, or in the case of Itanium, instruction encoding is obviously a little weird because it says 41 bits. But essentially, all the operands fit in that space. Other questions? Okay, so some other choices that instruction sets makes are what kind of instructions to provide. So we've seen condition codes. And a lot of architectures have decided that that's not a good way of doing things. And instead, we'll have a compare and jump instruction. So like MIPS has a branch of equal, which is the same effect as that x86 code. So this is, if R11 equals R12, jump to somewhere. Otherwise, just go to the next line of machine code. And, well, you know, there's advantages and disadvantages here. I think with modern processor designs, people wish they have chosen the second one, but from a point of view of, you know, what's convenient to implement in the hardware and also what's convenient for assembly programmers to use, there's arguments for both. The There's also issues of how to specify operands. So we've seen x86-64's displacement-based index scale, and that's x86's choice. Other architectures have made different choices, and often have their own weird ways of specifying operands. So for example, on ARM, you can, as part of the operand to like a move or an add instruction, you can specify a bit shift. It's just built into the operand. It's just like adding two addresses together to form a memory location is built in to an operand in ARM. Sorry, in x86. So R11 shifted by 3 is an operand you can give to many instructions in ARM. VAX, a very old ISA, let you have an operand which was a doubly dereferenced pointer. So you could have use R11 as a point, the location of a pointer, read the pointer there, and use that to read another value as an operand. And, well, there's advantages to having sort of more options for specifying these operands, what we call addressing modes, ways you can specify operands, in that it's more convenient for assembly programmers, but obviously it's more complicated to implement in hardware. So, like, for x86, we need this extra adding circuit here that every instruction could use. For the memory operand, for VAX, we need to somehow do two memory reads in the same instruction, which seems a little awkward, and so on. So questions about these examples of addressing modes, and we could imagine more depending on what you think is convenient for your assembly programmers. Okay. Another big choice that instruction sets make is how many operands to have. So in x86, we're used to two operands, that we have a source and a source and destination. That you have add x to y and store the result in y. Many architectures have chosen instead to have add x to y and store the result in z. And, well, the advantage of the first is that it means that you have to do less moving things around. And as we'll learn when we talk about how registers are typically implemented, usually it's kind of free in the hardware to store the result in a different register. It's kind of easier. The disadvantage is that the first version means that our machine code now needs to contain a third thing that we didn't need to put in there otherwise. And some architectures, like VAX, just decided to have both of these. They just implement an extra set of instructions so we can give the assembly programmers the option. Questions about number of operands decisions? So I've talked about a bunch of minutiae in instruction set design. How many registers you have, how many big instructions are, whether they're variable length. But we really haven't gone back to our big goals here, about what are our goals of instruction set design. And there's been two big philosophies that have been important, and maybe modern instruction sets are probably somewhere in between these. But the sort of two extreme philosophies that are good at illustrating the types of trade-offs we have in instruction set design. And one of these came out after the other and was called reduced instruction set computer. And to understand sort of what the philosophy, the people who came up with the reduced instruction set computer, which is, you know, something that it's probably not what any modern instruction set is designed with this philosophy, but it has this, some of these ideas are still used. You might say, what is it reduced from? And, well, you might say it's the other term we have is complex instruction set computer. But to understand what the reduced instruction set computer people were thinking, I think it's helpful to look at one of the dominant instruction sets at the time that some academics at Stanford and Berkeley came up with the reduced instruction set computer, and what those look like, and what they were reacting to. So here are some instructions on the VAX architecture. Give you a minute to look over that. Yes, these are instructions. that you can write in assembly. They are not macros, they're instructions. And something you'll see as you're reading this is that if you thought x86 is complicated instructions, these are way more complicated. And not complicated from a using sense, from a how must these be implemented sense, right? These are doing a lot more stuff than any x86 instruction you've probably seen. So we have matchsci, which is find a string in another string, basically, as an instruction. So somehow it's like doing a loop, scanning a string for another string. We have evaluate a polynomial, another loop. So we're doing x to the third, x to the fourth, that sort of thing. And we have basically a printf as an instruction. Yes?
What is haystack?
So the analogy is we're finding a needle in a haystack. So haystack is the thing we're searching in. Needle is the thing we're finding. And they're both sequences of bytes of a particular length. Other questions? Yeah?
If needle is a length, why would you need to specify the length without using the and of string operator?
So the question is, why do we need to specify the length of a needle if this is about strings? So I was saying strings as a likely use, but these are not null terminated search. This is a search for arbitrary bytes and arbitrary bytes. So it can handle, so if you're using it on strings, you get the past the string lengths, but you could also use it on just arbitrary bytes. Other questions? Yeah. So the question is, are these implemented by hardware or are they syntactic sugar? These are implemented by hardware, but you might say, how do we make hardware which implements things which are really complicated like this? And the people making processors at the time had this general strategy called microcode. This is a strategy that's still used today to implement large parts of processors. But typically the way these complicated instructions work is that there was some lookup table in the hardware which looked up a sequence of these sort of micro instructions. So there was sort of like basically a second instruction set for the particular microarchitecture that actually implemented these complicated instructions. So the common processor design basically would translate your machine code to a microarchitecture specific to the processor, you know, instructions to handle these complicated things where you have all these sorts of operations to do. And that meant that it was fairly simple from a hardware perspective to implement these things. They had a strategy that worked. I say fairly simple because you still need to like test that all of these worked and write this microcode, which is much harder to write than normal assembly because it's very, very machine specific and, you know, it doesn't have error checking and all that sort of things because you're working at a lower level, but that's how it was implemented. And sort of a consequence of this design is that we had these complex instructions that were implemented by just doing this translation to simpler operations, and that meant they often weren't faster. Like, often it would not be faster to use this matchsci instruction versus using simpler instructions to do the same thing, because maybe you as a compiler writer or an assembly writer could just come up with a better way of implementing it than whatever the microcode was. And the processor designers put a bunch of effort into supporting that microcode and writing out carefully the microcode that handled all the instructions. And that just made it so these were awkward to test, these processors that implement all these instructions. You have to verify all the instructions work, and essentially you're verifying a whole lot of software works, which is going to be hard. And if you get it wrong, it's much trickier to fix than if you like get something in the OS wrong. You can't do an OS upgrade. It's a processor upgrade, which you probably could do, but hard. But there's a bigger change. You might say, why did we have these instructions here? Like, why didn't we just have a standard library? Why wasn't this syntactic sugar to call a library function? Or to turn into a loop that the compiler had? And the answer was that at the time, writing assembly by hand was pretty common. Compilers were kind of a new thing. People didn't trust them that much. They often didn't produce very good assembly code. But that was changing. And compilers were starting to replace handwritten assembly, so it mattered less whether you had these fancy instructions or not. Right? Because if your compiler can generate the string comp loop for you, okay. You don't need to have an instruction for that. You'll just call a library function and your compiler couldn't put in the assembly there if it needs to. And so with this sort of change in mind, we had this different instruction set philosophy, which rather than being focused on being easy to program in assembly, which was a big reason why we'd have these complicated instructions here, like this is about things that are convenient for assembly programmers, focused on what was convenient for the hardware to implement efficiently with the assumption that compilers would fill the gap, that a compiler can figure out how to use simpler instructions, and it's actually easier for it to do, right? Because they're simpler. It doesn't have to figure out, is this thing function you wrote a find string and string function or not? It just writes this loop that you run in the function. And so this gave rise to the RISC instruction sets. And generally, they have fewer instructions. So they say, we're going to choose instructions that are easy to implement fast in hardware. So yes, we could provide like a find something and something else instruction, but that's not going to be something we can implement fast, so we're not going to provide it. We're going to say, if you want to do that, use the simpler instructions to do that. And we're going to focus on instructions we can implement really efficiently, with the hope that that's going to mean that we're going to run your programs more efficiently, and you're not going to care that the assembly is harder to program because you're not programming assembly anymore. You're using a compiler. And related to this, there's some decisions they made that make implementing the hardware easier. So a big thing that RISC instruction sets tend to do is they have separate instructions to access memory. So this is not what x86 does. In x86, like, you can add to a memory location. In a RISC-style instruction set, generally, you have to move values from memory to registers before you can do arithmetic or other operations on them. The only way you get values to and from memory is with dedicated move instructions. And this makes things simpler because now all our arithmetic instructions only have to worry about register operands, and that's easier to deal with in the hardware. We have separate instructions which can have different logic that's isolated from the arithmetic instructions for all the memory operations. And to make dealing with the machine code easier, they said, let's have fixed length instructions. Yes, this might mean that we can't make our machine code quite as small, but we're kind of already giving that up by having fewer instructions, so we'll have to have more instructions in a typical program. But that's going to make implementing the hardware faster. And it's going to make easier to do some techniques we'll talk about later in the semester. And as part of having simpler instructions, we're going to avoid things like we're not going to have instructions that do loops, because we don't want to have us have to use that microcode approach. That sort of approach to instruction implementation. We want them all to be just straightforward one operation, essentially. Also means we probably won't have multiple memory operations, because that's sort of more than one operation per instruction. And we're going to have few addressing modes to keep our logic simpler. We're not going to do what x86 does and have 20 different ways to specify a memory location. We're just going to have a couple to make it simpler in the hardware. So questions about these design choices that are focused on making it easier to implement hardware that makes these instructions fast? Yes?
So x86 doesn't have fixed length
So the question is, x86 doesn't do much of this? Yes. No fixed length instructions, no separate instructions to access memory, and so on. Why that happened. Okay. Another thing that's on here that's maybe a little subtle is more registers. So one of the observations the RISC people made is that if we have less logic to implement complex instructions, we can use that space in our hardware to add storage for the processor. And that's something that will make up for having simpler instructions, right? If the compiler has more registers available, hopefully it can make our code faster by using those registers rather than using these complex instructions. Okay, so as you may have noticed from x86, it seems like maybe CISC is the winner, but if you look at what compilers generate, compilers tend to use a subset of instructions. x86 has 1,500 instructions. Your typical program doesn't use most of those. It uses a very small subset, similar to the RISC processors. And the implementation of x86 often converts more complicated instructions, like instructions that access memory, to RISC-like instructions. So often a step in a modern design of x86 will like convert an add to memory instruction internally to a move from memory to register, add, move back. So the real implementation looks more like these RISC processors, even if that's not the instruction set. There's just some layer on top of that. But I point out RISC versus CISC because these give us two like big design philosophies you see in instruction sets. So one is make it easy for the assembly programmer. The other is make it easy for the hardware designer. And CISC is the extreme of making it easy for the assembly programmer. RISC is the extreme of making it easy for the hardware designer. There's no firm line, and I would say that sort of modern implementations are somewhere in between, and maybe there's some other goals that are neither of these two issues involved in them. So that's where I'll finish up today. So next time we'll talk about the instruction set we'll be implementing, YID664.